wondering, so you do you deny that the gas chambers actually existed during the Holocaust yourself? Do you believe that?
From what I can see, the way these Jewish people operate, yes, I can understand that they're lying.
The 9/11 truth kind of conspiracy movement have at their core some pretty right-wing assumptions, primarily that there's sort of mythical idealized past in the United States that was perfect, and then it was somehow corrupted by an outside, you know, malevolent force. So that particular assumption is has pretty racist and homophobic features to it, and it's a distortion of reality.
Please leave the building.
Can you? I'm with Cebu Radio.
Please,
can you talk about why you're hosting a Nazi? Can you talk about?
This is Circle A Radio. When Holocaust denier David Irving arrived at the Portland Embassy Suites Airport Hotel on July 19th to give a presentation, he and presentation attendees, most of whom were members of the Portland 9/11 Truth Alliance, were greeted by about 50 anti-Nazi protesters. Included among the protesters were members of Rose City Antifa, an organization consisting of anti-fascist, anti-racist activists. Attendees and protesters found themselves engaged in dialogue, some of which grew quite heated. The 9/11 Truth Movement has vastly grown in number since the September 11th attacks on the U.S. At issue is the relationship that has occurred between 9/11 truthers and those like Irving, who effectively feed their hunger to define 9/11 as an act of international Jewish conspiracy. Tonight, we will provide some of the history of Nazi and racist skinhead action in the Northwest. We will also share some of the conversations between protesters and attendees at the Irving event and speak with members of Rose City Antifa. The Northwest, and more specifically Oregon, has a long history of anti-Semitic and racist activity. As early as 1917, wartime stress, emphasis on patriotism, distrust of German Americans, eugenic campaigns, and anti-Catholic bigotry created fertile ground for the rise of the American Protective Association, the Federation of Patriotic Societies, and the Ku Klux Klan. With a combined membership estimated at more than 64,000 Oregonians, these organizations fed on the fear and distrust of residents in a period of social flux and uncertainty. Although minorities were few in number, racism and bigotry were imported ideas. They came with newcomers from other parts of the country and grew in soil that already nurtured suspicion and tendencies to vigilante action. Chapters of the Ku Klux Klan formed in Tillamook, Medford, Eugene, and Portland. Robed Klansmen paraded in the streets, ignited crosses on hillsides, nailed American flags to the doors of Catholic schools, and intimidated African Americans. Large neighborhoods of Portland, Garthwick, Dunthorpe, Eastmoreland, and Westmoreland, along with Lake Oswego, were kept white for decades by subtle but effective discrimination. On December 22, 1921, thousands of Oregonians attended a speech at Portland's Municipal Auditorium given by Reverend Reuben Sawyer, a pastor at Portland's Eastside Christian Church. Sawyer was a popular Klan speaker who traveled to cities throughout the state to help organize new chapters or claverns. On the subject of white supremacy, Sawyer urged that his listeners not lose sight of the fact that the white race is the ruling race by right of inheritance, and that it does not intend to surrender this right or to compromise it with another race, black, red, yellow, or brown. By this time, there were as many as 250 Klan members in the state. Well into the century, laws excluded blacks from owning land or even technically living in the state. Running with support from the Ku Klux Klan for governor in 1923, Walter M. Pierce beat incumbent Governor George Olcott, a presumed Roman Catholic, winning more votes than any previous gubernatorial candidate. In his campaign, Pierce supported the Klan's compulsory public school attendance initiative designed to prevent children from attending Catholic schools. It was common to see signs in the windows of restaurants and other businesses throughout the 40s and 50s that read, "We cater to white trade only." Blacks were turned down for specialized jobs they had worked at all their lives, including stevedores, truck drivers, and laundry workers, because of union laws that did not allow blacks to join their ranks. And although Jim Crow officially ended with the passage of the civil rights legislation in the 60s, one only needs to jump ahead two more decades to find that racist, anti-Semitic activism is alive and well in Portland. The Northwest Hammerskin chapter represents the northwestern United States of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, and North Dakota. Its members advocate white power and the preservation of the white race. This group, which Skinhead started 20 years ago in Dallas, Texas, as the Confederate Hammerskins, concentrates its hatred on Jews and people of color, sexual minorities, and most recently, immigrants and people of Middle Eastern descent. Perhaps the most notorious skinhead-related crime in the 1980s was the brutal baseball bat murder of an Ethiopian immigrant, Mulugeta Sera, in Portland by three members of the racist skinhead group, East Side White Pride. After a week-long investigation, Ken Mieske, Kyle Brewster, and Steve Strasser were arrested. In 1990, Mieske was convicted of first-degree murder. Brewster and Strasser were convicted of manslaughter and assault. Brewster was released in November 2002, but in 2006 violated parole and was sent back to prison. The Neo-Nazi American Front was founded in 1990 in Portland by Bob Hike. Volksfront, another neo-Nazi organization, was founded by Randall Lee Krieger in 1994, along with three other inmates in an Oregon prison. In December of 2004, the Tualatin Valley Skins, a neo-Nazi skinhead group based in the suburbs around Portland, announced plans to launch a new recruitment drive with a rally and flyering campaign to be held in Southwest Portland on January 8, 2005. The location they picked for the rally, Gabriel Park, lies in an area with a large Jewish and Middle Eastern population. These were the groups the skinheads primarily attacked in their flyers, along with gays, communists, and people of color. However, when over 300 Portlanders showed up at the proposed site of the neo-Nazi rally to protest them, the skinheads failed to appear. And on the 8th of this month, Portland neo-Nazi Daniel Lee Jones was arrested for mailing a noose to the president of the Ohio chapter of the NAACP. Jones is best known for his 2000 campaign of flying Third Reich flags over the Portland metro area by means of helium balloons. Of these groups, it was a Hammerskin Hammerfest event that brought Portland activists to found Antifa in 2007. When it was learned that a meeting of the Hammerskin Nation was set for the Sherwood Elks Lodge, which is about 15 miles from Portland, Antifa was formed with a specific intent to shut Hammerfest down. We now speak with Antifa members Danny and Casey about their work in the organization and their take on the link between anti-Semitism and the 9/11 Truth Alliance. We begin with Danny, who shares some of her activist history.
I started off, I was involved with Anti-Racist Action, which were part of the ARA network. I was involved with Anti-Racist Action in another state at the end of high school when I finished. And then I moved here to Portland last year and got involved with Rose City Antifa because I found out that that was the chapter of ARA here. And it's different. A lot of the chapters do different things based on what's needed in their area. So a lot of the tactics that we're doing here I hadn't experienced with ARA back home, but I really liked what they were doing here too.
And what were they doing when you got here?
Well, when I talked to them about the group, they were telling me about some of the campaigns they were doing, outing some of the neo-Nazis in Portland by going into their neighborhoods and letting their neighbors know who they were, basically. And I thought that was a really good tactic. It was really effective. A lot of people there's some people that haven't agreed with it, but I think that it's important to make things difficult for them, because if they're busy looking for somewhere else to live or a new job, they can't spend time recruiting kids at high schools or, you know, being violent, hurting people. So I thought that was really interesting.
In regard to that tactic of outing people, like posting their personal information, posting their phone numbers and where they live, what do you say to people that criticize Antifa and saying that you are being just as fascistic as the people that you are labeling as fascists?
Well, we don't advocate violence or, like, you know, going to their houses or hurting them. We just think that if their landlords know who they are, they're not going to want someone who's a neo-Nazi, and a lot of them have violent backgrounds, violent criminal histories, and they aren't going to want people who have, you know, hurt other people, especially based on their race or who they are, to be living there. And so while it is a tactic that, you know, a lot of people think might be mean or, you know, might not be, I guess, the most polite thing to do, I just think that it's effective. I mean, we, you know, all kinds of people try to talk to them when, you know, they've been hearing all their lives about, you know, what, like, specifically neo-Nazis, like, we've been hearing all our lives what people went through in the Holocaust, and then they think that that wasn't a big deal or that it was okay. But I think, you know, these people know what they're doing, and they have so much hate that while it'd be great if they changed their minds or they stopped hurting people and stopped being violent, that'd be great, but it's a lot of them, the ones that we try to out are more organizers. It's not, you know, a high school kid who's just learning about it. You know, we wouldn't do anything like that. It's people who are really out there and, you know, advocating murdering people.
And what do you say to this free speech issue that you are encroaching on their right to free speech? Why shouldn't they be able to talk about the things that they want to talk about?
They can talk about what they want to, but I think it's important for us to counter it, or for any kind of people to counter it, and for them to know that it's not something that's welcome or that people agree with. You know, a lot of people tell us, why don't you just ignore them? It's just a fringe group. But when they get ignored, they grow, and people don't see that they're being opposed, or people don't hear all of the story about them, and, you know, think that, oh, it's not a big deal, until, you know, someone gets murdered or someone gets beat up or something like that. So while they can say what they want, I think we have a right to say what we want also, and to make sure that people understand who they are. But a lot of people aren't sure about that.
Danny discusses the logic behind identity and anonymity among members of Antifa. There's also been criticism leveled at Antifa about hiding your identity and covering up your faces and that kind of thing, kind of treating it in a way, you know, if you're brave enough to organize and take part in these demonstrations, then, you know, you should be brave enough about revealing your identity. But I would guess that that goes a bit deeper for you, who are basically putting yourselves on the line and protesting some folks that have ties to some pretty dangerous, violent action. What do you have to say to that?
Yeah, definitely. What you just said is the main reason that we do this. It'd be great if we can just be public and, you know, hand out flyers and talk to people about it on the street. But unfortunately, like you said, the people that we're outing, you know, especially like the organizers of the neo-Nazi groups, a lot of them have really violent criminal histories. You know, a lot of them have guns, and a lot, and you know, most of them have publicly said that if they find out who we are, you know, they'll kill us, or they'll, you know, and this has happened in other places too. People have gotten, you know, beat up really bad for being part of anti-fascist groups. So we think that it's the only way that we can really do this work and, you know, stay safe or stay alive is to not let people know who we actually are, you know, because if the neo-Nazis find out, then, you know, they'd be really violent towards us. And so if we want to continue to do the work, then we couldn't, you know, unfortunately can't at this point put ourselves out there like that.
On June 10th of this year, Valdis Analuskas, a self-described white separatist who is involved in Holocaust denial circles, gave a presentation to a group of sympathizers in Portland. Danny discusses the action that Antifa took to try to shut this event down.
Learned about that pretty last minute. I think it was only a couple days before it was supposed to happen. And so what we did is we heard that it was going to be at Laughing Horse Books. And, you know, Laughing Horse is, you know, supposed to be a radical bookstore. And we thought, well, maybe they just don't realize who they are, you know, who they're inviting. And so we let them know and told them that, you know, they need to cancel the event because this person is a Holocaust denier. Otherwise, we're going to let the community know that they're supporting this. And so I think it was after like a day or two, once they were able to all get together, we found out that the people, a couple of the people were on the board of the, or, you know, involved in the cooperative, and they invited him, knowing who he was, but most of the other people that worked there didn't know. They had no idea, and so they canceled it. They didn't want Holocaust denier at their bookstore, and so the 9/11 truth people who invited him there found another place. I can't remember exactly what it was, but as soon as we found out it was going to be there, we talked to them, and they canceled it. And so they ended up just taking him to, I believe it was like a restaurant or a cafe, and it wasn't as big as it was supposed to be.
And who were the two board members on at the Laughing Horse Collective?
Tim Titred and Tim Calvert.
Are these two folks no longer on the board that you know of?
I believe that Tim Calvert resigned, and I'm not sure if Tim Titred is there. I think he was involved with the co-op also. He was one of the people there, all board members who are involved with working there, and I'm not sure if he's still involved with it or not. But I believe that Tim Calvert resigned. There was talk about whether or not he should stay with amongst the bookstore, and I think that he resigned before they decided yes or no.
David Irving is widely known as an anti-Semitic Holocaust denier, and again, the 9/11 group brought him to Portland, and that got a lot more wider coverage than the first event. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. David Irving is a lot better known. He travels all over. He's actually on tour right now on the East Coast, and, you know, there's area people trying to get those shut down also right now, but he came to Portland in July and spoke at one of the hotels near the airport, and so we tried getting it shut down and had a lot of people call, and they didn't shut it down, so a group of people went and protested and, you know, just let the people there know what was going on and that there was a Holocaust denier, a very well-known Holocaust denier, at that hotel.
You actually contacted the hotel. What kind of communication did you have with them What was their reaction to what you were telling them?
I can't remember exactly what they had said at that specific hotel, but what most of them have said at that or for other meetings that we've tried to talk to people at hotels is that, you know, they can't just cancel something they had already planned and that it's a free speech issue. And basically, a lot of the people individually don't support it, but coming from the top, because we'll try to contact the, you know, the people that are in charge of the entire country's hotels, and they just don't want to have to deal with an issue so, like, controversial, have to, like, you know, cancel something and then worry about getting harassed for canceling an event because of, you know, they think it's a free speech issue and that they aren't sure if they can legally do that or not. It's legal to, at their private establishment, host whoever they want.
We now speak with Casey, who talks about the founding of Rose City Antifa. Can you share what you feel comfortable with as far as your experiences and background that brought you to be involved in Portland Antifa?
Well, in terms of specifically Portland, ARA, or Rose City Antifa, it really started out as sort of an ad hoc group of people that were interested in specifically stopping the Hammerfest event from going on without any sort of disruption here in Portland. So it started out as kind of this ad hoc group that just organized around that specific event. And then when it was over with, a few of us got together and felt like it was important to have a group that was doing this work on an ongoing basis. So we would have some idea of who were the key players and have some more of a heads up and more of a background before a crisis sort of emerged. So that was how I got involved here. In the past, I've been involved in different kinds of political work. When I was much younger, I was involved in similar, like, Antifa type stuff around kind of the punk and skinhead subculture, trying to keep Nazi skinheads from coming to shows and that sort of a thing. And then I got involved in sort of other kinds of political work prior to moving to Portland. And then Portland, of course, has kind of a long history of having a real active right-wing white supremacist group. So it became more pressing to sort of get back into that work when I moved here.
Antifa has chosen a couple of tactics in terms of countering Nazi activism in the Northwest. And you recently put out a statement that gave information about local Nazis and local skinheads in the area. And you went so far as to, of course, name them and give their phone numbers and addresses. Can you tell us a little bit about why Antifa has chosen that as direct action and what some of the backlash has been?
Well, it's a tactic that at first some people balk at, but, you know, really what we find with it is that when these people are allowed to sort of fly under the radar, they increase in power. And also we want to sort of open it up so that it's a whole community is dealing with it, and it's sort of not just a specific little subcultural ghetto that is interested in this work and is pursuing these people, but it becomes more of a community effort. And we feel like that's an effective way of doing it. It also keeps them so that they're constantly having to stay busy, kind of duck and covering, frankly. And so when they're busy having to, like, move or, like, find a new job, that's all time that they're not, like, recruiting new people or gathering, you know, more and more power towards their movement. So it's frankly a way of keeping them on the defense and keeping them kind of ducking and covering. Also, we tend to do it really when we don't just arbitrarily pick people that have racist beliefs. We do it really specifically for people that are political organizers that are, you know, that are doing active political work towards the white separatist movement. So those are the people that we choose. And we feel like it's actually been very successful, like particularly with the Volksfront organization. They've been forced to kind of, a few of the people have been forced to move from the area. It splits them up farther, which makes it harder for them to, you know, organize when they're all living all over the country in different places, rather than when you have a big crew of them all living in the same city. You know, so I think we've been pretty successful with it. It's really, I guess, judged by its success. But, and also, I mean, we feel like that it's a matter of, like, a lot of people are like, well, it's their free speech, blah, 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 but we feel like it's within our free speech rights to say, hey, this guy that you work with is a Nazi that paralyzed a black man that's a father of three, you know, because he's a racist. We feel like it's just a matter of community safety. Like, people should know, hey, I live next door to somebody that killed somebody in a hate crime. I mean, I don't like that term, hate crime, but, you know, murdered somebody because of the color of their skin. People should know that.
In this segment, the Circle A radio reporter interviews David Westerlund, who had come to listen to the June 19th presentation by David Irving. He presents a perfect example of the 9/11 Truth Movement members who have come to follow Irving. Westerlund's comments are, to say the least, deluded, disturbing, and quite frightening.
Are you folks here for the David Irving event?
Pardon me?
Are you here for the David Irving event?
Yes.
Can you tell me why you've come today?
Because David Irving is trying to get the truth out about what really happened during World War II.
He was proven to be a Holocaust denier in a court of law in England, where they have quite harsh proof.
I know David Irving, I know Bradley Smith, I know Ernst Zundel. None of them deny the Holocaust. They only deny that the gas chambers existed.
Okay, but he has been proven in a court of law to be a Holocaust denier.
Let's go words quieter. I'd be welcome to talk with you.
Well, I'm just wondering, so do you deny that the gas chambers actually existed during the Holocaust yourself? Do you believe that?
From what I can see, the way these Jewish people operate, yes, I can understand that they're lying. Eisenhower, in his book, made no mention of the gas chambers in his complete 550-page book on World War II. Churchill never made any mention of it in any of his writings.
So do you believe that the Holocaust survivors are making up the stories about the gas chambers?
No, I believe the people at Nuremberg made up the story about the gas chambers and let it expand.
But what about the survivors of the Holocaust, people who are still alive who've been telling the story?
Personally, with Mr. Sadowski, he was number 88 at Auschwitz, and he talked about pulling the bodies out of the gas chambers directly. No cleaning of the gas chambers or any degasification. I know he was lying.
And what is the importance to you of people like David Irving being able to speak?
I want the truth to come out. Whatever is the truth. If the truth is there were gas chambers, I want to know that. But all indications to me, because the Jewish press will not allow anybody to testify in Germany or Poland about these gas chambers or to prove today with forensic evidence that it ever happened, I can't believe what our press tells us.
So, sir, how did you find out about this event?
This event? I have heard David Irving before. Last year I missed it. I had to fly all the way down to Phoenix to hear him in his yearly talk.
And are you involved in any white nationalist organizations yourself?
I'm sorry, any what?
Are you involved in any white nationalist organizations?
Let me say that all of the Holocaust, quote, deniers, unquote, I know of, do not have racial prejudice until it comes to demonstrations like this.
I found out about it on a neo-Nazi website, however, so I'm wondering about the connection between neo-Nazi organizing and people like David Irving.
I have tears in my eyes because the neo-Nazis and David Irving are connected in any way, but yes, they are connected. And I've seen the neo-Nazis debating with people like Erwin Zundo on the Holocaust. Oh, they like to agree with that, but the neo-Nazis are a complete different organization than the revisionists. And let's call us revisionists. We need to change World War history.
But in the court of law, they didn't call him a revisionist. They actually said he was a Holocaust denier in the court of law. So do you deny what the court of law...
He went into a court. David Irving went into a court without a lawyer by himself against $1 million worth of lawyers that Jewish woman from...
Deborah,
yes, that she had
who
in England.
His right to freedom.
Yes. Now you go back to the Zundel trial in Toronto, Canada, where he proved to the Toronto, Canada, the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court of Canada, he proved... No one died in the gas chamber in Auschwitz during World War II. He proved it. He got off. Now he's in jail. He's in jail in Germany.
Well, he's here today, right?
No, I'm talking about Zundo.
Oh, Zundo.
Ernst Zundo.
Uh-huh.
And his wife, Ingrid Rimlin.
And he's in jail for what?
He's in jail for talking about the Holocaust.
And denying that it happened.
He's denying the gas chamber.
So you're saying that these people don't deny that the Holocaust itself happened?
Not one of them. Not one of the Holocaust deniers will deny that more Jewish people died in the concentration camps, a higher percentage than other people died. Let's say than the German people died. A lot of people died during World War II. But if you were the person in Nazi Germany handing out the food, would you send it to the Eastern Front where the troops were fighting the Russians? Or would you send it to the work camps like Auschwitz? Answer me that question.
I can't answer that question.
Okay.
I'm here to ask questions.
Okay.
And what is your name, sir?
David Westerlund.
And you flew in for this?
No, I flew in for the one last year.
Okay, so you live here in Portland?
I live nearby.
And what you said you hope to get a truth out of this event?
No. I want the truth to come out. I think David Irving is telling the truth. I don't think the Jewish press is telling the truth.
And who is the Jewish press?
CNN is a very big Jewish press organization. I see on CNN a blue six-pointed star showing up for split seconds at a time. They're trying to just get us acclimated.
How is it going to change our society once what you call the truth comes out?
I hope it comes out. I don't know if it will. It looks like we're fighting a losing battle.
And what would you hope for? What would you hope to see?
Okay, I envy people who will risk their lives, risk their monetary things like David Irving to come out with the truth. I'm a man that believes in the truth. Not in whether I'll go to jail or not. David Irving believes in that.
Thank you for talking with me. I'm with KBOO Radio.
It was indeed a pleasure. Thank you.
Listening to Circle A Radio here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. We go back to Antifa activist Casey, who gives her thoughts on the relationship between Nazi enthusiasts and the 9/11 Truth Alliance. What do you make of this link that has been established in Portland and other places as well in regard to the 9/11 truth movement and anti-Semitic Holocaust deniers like David Irving, who appeared here recently. Can you tell us a little bit about that event and
right.
what you know about who organized it, and what's at the crux of that relationship, in your opinion?
Well, ideologically, I would say that the 9/11 truth kind of conspiracy movements have at their core some pretty right-wing assumptions, primarily that there's sort of mythical, idealized past in the United States that was perfect, and then it was somehow corrupted by an outside, you know, malevolent force. So that particular assumption is pretty racist and homophobic features to it, and is a distortion of reality. So, but I think a lot of people are attracted to conspiracy theories because they sort of know vaguely that something's not going right, that there's sort of some kind of big social structures that they don't totally understand, or that is out to get them. I don't know if that's maybe being a little trite about it, but, and so they're attracted to this, but particularly if they don't have much of a very sophisticated political analysis ahead of time. It's much more easy to understand, oh, there's a clandestine group behind the curtain that's like this little council of evil people that are controlling the world, rather than trying to understand complex systems of oppression, you know, over time and how they intersect, et cetera. So I think that also the 9/11 truth movement particularly is sort of, so that, I feel like that intellectual laziness lends itself to people not really having a very critical mind when they are presented with more fascist ideas. They don't know how to discern them if they're basically wrapped in this package of, oh, we're anti-war and we just want, you know, small groups, even though they're talking about racial balkanization. So there's the intellectual problems with that ideology. And then the other part of it is that there's not really, oftentimes they don't posit a counter theory. They're just saying, oh, well, the 9/11 didn't go down the way that it was supposed to. So then there's sort of this vacuum as to, like, what really went on. And, I mean, that could be filled with anything, from, like, Martians to, you know, the Bush administration to, you know, and it basically lends itself very easily to sort of the traditional Zionist conspiracy, anti-Semitic kind of thinking. Like, I feel like the word banker gets used pretty much as a euphemism from, you know, Jew. So I think ideologically it's very vulnerable to fascists, you know, fascists with any kind of, you know, sophistication that aren't, like, marching around. But that being said, Irving is a pretty much an outright Nazi. I mean, the man loves Hitler. I mean, he writes gushing books about the greatness of Hitler and, you know, sells Nazi memorabilia. He identifies as a fascist racialist. I mean, and specifically here in Portland, the two key people that have sort of taken the 9/11 Truth Alliance down that primrose path are Tim Calvert and Tim Titchred. And they sort of had this right-wing drift going on. And they became involved in the Pacifica Forum, which is this sort of pseudo-intellectual forum that goes on in Eugene, which the common thread through the speakers that they bring there is anti-Semitism, essentially. I mean, that's pretty widely available information. They've hosted, you know, some pretty crazily far-right speakers in the past, and it's sort of a continuing theme with them. So they started getting involved with that, and that's how they found out about Valdis Adaluskas. And he and Kim Calvert was, you know, involved in Laughing Horse books, and so he wanted to bring him there. And that's when Rose City Antifa got involved and shut down that event and sort of began this whole process of trying to out Tim Calvert in the community and have basically what was disturbing about the whole situation is he was someone that was pretty well ensconced in some leftist institutions in Portland, which I think is why it made it very confusing for people. They're not used to seeing someone like that that's, you know, looks basically kind of like a hippie liberal guy. He rides bikes, you know, he's in collectives. but he was bringing fascists to town and sort of harbored these conspiracy theories that eventually devolved into straight, like, fascism, and particularly anti-Semitism. Oh, and particularly with the David Irving event, the 9/11 Truth Alliance was the single largest group that actually went to that event. I think they had something like 9 people go, and Kim Chitrid posted, like, wrote this gushing letter to David Irving about how excited he was to see him, et cetera, et cetera. Kim Calvert actually didn't go to that event, but we feel like that may have been largely because of the scrutiny that we had already brought upon him with outing him and the Laughing Horse Books and the City Bikes Collective. That information is available on Indie Media. We actually posted the letter that Chitrid wrote, et cetera.
That's awesome. There was recently an article in the Willamette Week here written by James Pipkin.
Yeah. Yep.
And he got a number of responses about that article. And, of course, one of the best ones came from Portland Antifa about him not actually being above board in his article about contact that he had with Antifa. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was kind of a horrible thing to behold from the beginning. So really, our engagement with Pitkin started with he wrote a Rogue of the Week piece on us. And he asked for an interview, and we essentially knew that we assumed that was going to be what we were, Rogue of the Week. Unfortunately, Willamette Week sort of has this pattern of making radical organizations in Portland Rogue of the Week. So we assumed that's what we were going to be. But then when it came out, what was disturbing about it was that there were factual inaccuracies. And it was like a real brief piece. I mean, they misquoted the person's name that did the interview. They misquoted our acronym. They called it, and at the time, they called us PARA as our acronym, which we felt like perhaps could have been to try to be like, associate us with a more militant, you know, stance, like, ooh, they're paramilitary. But who knows? But so it wasn't really that great of a sign that there were inaccuracies in, like, a very short piece already, and there wasn't, like, basic fact-checking. Then shortly after that, he called our voicemail, and we're busy all the time. Our organization is involved in a lot of different stuff. We also have lives and jobs, et cetera. We failed to call him back within less than 2 days, and within less than 2 days, he posted this blog entry on the Willamette Week site, basically, you know, goading us, basically acting like, oh, these people are too afraid to talk to me. Like, I mean, just, you know, it was obvious from the get-go that what he was really looking for with us was, you know, just a hit piece. He wanted to be like, you know, to expose us for being this terrible, you know, organization. So after that, we felt like, I mean, we want to talk about these issues. Like, we think, obviously, we do this work. We think it's really important that people think about the radical right and think about issues of race, and particularly what's going on here in Portland. And so we wanted to have this platform, and we felt like we weren't looking for, like, a glowing review. I mean, we understand that the kind of work we do is not what everybody wants to do. And, in fact, we wish there were all these different kinds of anti-racist organizing going on in Portland, because there are many facets to racism, clearly, besides just, you know, attacking the extreme right. So we wanted at least our perspective to be included in sort of a spectrum of anti-racist tactics and at least be accurately portrayed. So we contacted the editor on the Willamette Week, Mark Zuskin, and started this sort of conversation with him about it. And we said, you know, we want you to take down, like, change the things that are factually inaccurate, and we want, like, at least a fair interview. We don't expect it to be, like, a go Antifa piece, but we want at least a fair interview. We agreed to do the interview under specific conditions. Like, you will change the factual inaccuracies. You will mention that this blog that was basically goading us and trying to paint us in the worst possible light was put up less than 2 days after he even tried to call us. And he agreed to that. So 2 weeks later, it still wasn't, none of those things were done. Like, none of the factual inaccuracies were amended. And so we felt like there just wasn't even baseline assurance that we weren't just going to be strung along into basically being, using our own quotes, like chopping up our own quotes to be used against us. In addition, I should mention that, like, during that entire time, other parts of the anti-racist community were contacting him to try to give him background information. There was a lot of solidarity and feeling like we were, like, what's going on here? Like, we have a right-wing resurgence in this country. We have people that are talking about taking back America. And what do you think they're talking about? Like, why are you attacking an anti-racist group at this time? Like, that's just completely ridiculous. And he basically wasn't responsive to any of that. It was like he did not want to research the issue. He did not want to find out about what the Pacifica Forum was. He didn't want to know any background information about any of the people, like Tim Calvert or Tim Tittred. And he just didn't want to put, you know, he had no interest in providing context at all for our tactics. He was strictly interested in saying, these people are monsters. They publish people's personal information, and that is just a horrible thing to do. And that was his entire point. So our feeling was, at a point, like, I think, as I said earlier, a lot of people that are coming from more of a liberally or, you know, like, the Democrat type of a standpoint really balk at our tactics initially. However, like, when you discuss it further and you sort of explain, these discussions have real consequences in the real world, et cetera, et cetera. They come around, even if they don't necessarily support what you're doing and they don't think that that's effective, they at least understand where you're coming from. And it seems like, I mean, he talked to really intelligent people that clearly presented great arguments, and he was completely impervious to it. And at a point, we just felt like, there must be something going on here ideologically, particularly after reading the article. Because at that point, people had contacted him. He had done interviews with, like, Eric Ward and all these different people, and, like, still was, like, completely unmoved. Was just, like, you know, painted a completely inaccurate picture of Tim Tittred and Tim Calvert. You know, it seemed like he definitely had a clear agenda with it, and we can only speculate as to why. You know, he has that agenda.
Casey goes on to discuss another Willamette Week piece written by James Pitkin about Central Precinct Captain Mark Krueger, a Portland police officer who is also a Nazi enthusiast.
He wrote this new piece. The same reporter wrote a new piece essentially defending a police officer that's a Nazi. I mean, Mark Krueger is a pretty, you know, horrible human being. He's been, you know, I mean, he's a Nazi enthusiast. He's not involved, to our knowledge, with any, like, explicit political organizing, but he's a police officer that's able to act upon his racist beliefs in a, you know, on a daily basis, you know. So, I don't know, but he took the opportunity to basically defend him. So that, you know, it's very suspicious. It seems like these things can't be just random facts, that he's providing this platform for people that are fascist, or if not outright fascist, racist, to essentially make them look like innocent victims.
Is there anything that you would like the public to know about Portland Antifa, who might be swayed by the Pitkin Willamette Week article?
Well, I think, I mean, the big thing that people need to deal with in Portland is, I mean, I think sort of the elephant in the room a lot is this white privilege that's just, you know, ubiquitous here. And I think when people see a person like Tim Tittred or Tim Calvert, they relate to that person because it looks like somebody they're friends with, or it looks like themselves, frankly. And I think that there's this tendency in sort of the liberal left to, like, almost act like it's a virtue to say, oh, well, I will stand up for the right of any Nazi to speak their mind because that's part of it. And it's really like, what that says to me is that you are so abstracted from the real consequences of racism that you don't understand what the real results of this ideology is in the world. And furthermore, you are having solidarity with another white person as a knee-jerk reaction rather than having solidarity with the people that they want to put in the ovens. And to me, that's really deeply disturbing. And I think people need to really re-examine when they have that instant response of, like, sort of uncriticized ideas about free speech. Free speech means that a government doesn't have the right to come in and stop your meeting and tell you to stop saying something. Free speech doesn't mean that you can say whatever thing and no one has the right to criticize you. And furthermore, ideas have power in the world, and we know what the power of these ideas are. They're murder and genocide, eventually. And even on the small scale, these groups can enact damage. Like, even a group of three racists can go out and murder somebody, and that's, you know, enough of a consequence. I just think people really need to think about how their privilege is affecting how they're reading information. And I think people need to think about what it would mean to be in solidarity with people that are at the bottom of the pyramid and people that are oppressed. I think in Portland it's very easy for people to want to just, like, cover their eyes and their ears and just be like, oh, look, we have our magical, you know, liberal paradise where everybody has gardens and we all ride our bikes. I mean, and really there's a very sinister underbelly there of privilege and race. And these are all issues that people just break out in hives when you try to talk about them. I mean, no one likes to talk about race. It's not a fun topic, but it's something that we really have to deal with, and we need to have these conversations, and we need to unite to say that here's the line. Like, when you go into fascist ideology, that's not okay, particularly in the left. I mean, that's just absurd. You can't get so comfortable that you don't have any critical thinking skills anymore, because, you know, then you're just like a sitting duck for any old ideology that comes wearing the right outfit. And people also should know, in terms of the Willamette Week article particularly, that the media has a tremendous power to lie, and people really need to think about that. Like, the inaccuracy of that article was astounding, and so a reporter's personal bias affects information you're receiving. And not just personal bias, but the overall bias of the paper. Willamette Week sort of has this long history of being sort of maybe, you know, Democrat, middle-of-the-road politics. And really coming down very hard on the radical left. And so people just need to know, like, they can just completely lie.
We leave you with David Irving, the man who Tim Calvert, Tim Tetrud, and a good portion of the 9/11 Truth Alliance of Portland follow and admire. This excerpt is part of a 2008 interview conducted by Max Blumenthal for the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Are you a Holocaust denier?
No, good Lord, no. If anyone reads my books, takes the trouble to read my books, they'll see the facts.
But when I challenged Irving, the hardcore Holocaust denier came out of his shell. You said more people died on the backseat of Edward Kennedy's car at Chappaquiddick than ever died in a gas chamber at Auschwitz. How is that not denying?
The right quotation, the actual quotation, more people died on the backseat of Edward Kennedy's car at Chappaquiddick, meaning the one woman, Mary Jo Kopechne, than ever died in that gas chamber at Auschwitz, meaning the one that's shown the tourists. And the Poles now admit, they put on the inscription outside, they admit that the building was built 3 years after World War II was over. So it's a fake.
You contend that there was a Holocaust, though.
I didn't use the word Holocaust. I think the word Holocaust is an odious commercial term that's been developed by big agencies to make money. I think that the people who are making the money are not the ones who suffered, but big agencies who are just screwing what money they can out of people who are very rich.
You deny that there was a Holocaust by denying the very term Holocaust. or a Shoah.
I think the word Holocaust is odious. It's American commercialism at its worst.
God works in mysterious ways, but here we agree he appears to be working remorselessly towards a final solution which may cruelly wipe out not only blacks and homosexuals, but a large part of the drug addicts and sexually promiscuous and indiscriminate heterosexual population as well.
Is that from my diary or from some talk I gave? I don't know.
You said that to a South African reporter.
You all know what reporters do with words.
So you didn't say that. Do you hold that view?
I hold that view partially, as I just said, that God is moving in a mysterious way when he has engineered some kind of illness.
You've said that the Jews are the architects of their own destruction. Do you still hold that view?
I was asked in one of the trials whether I was saying that the Jews were responsible for Auschwitz, and I said the Alpha and the Omega of it is, yes, they were. But between Alpha and Omega, there are a lot of Greek letters of the alphabet describing the individual stages. Everybody is the architect of his own misfortune, and that includes David Irving. And another limerick was one that I wrote down in the diary immediately afterwards, which ran, I'm a baby Aryan, I'm not Jewish or sectarian, I have no plans to marry an ape or Rastafarian. And people took grave exception to that. They called it racist, but that's nonsense.
You have been listening to Circle A Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. We'd like to thank you for becoming a member of KBOO during our recent membership drive, and especially thank those who have directly supported us and the work we do here. You can listen to past shows at our archives on the KBOO website, www.kboo.fm, and you can also contact us through there or through circlearadio@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.